Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it. Let's get together on this for the things that the heart of the issues that faces every day. It's a good thing this isn't recorded. We're doing this live, you can tell. The issues that faces every day right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own, and I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance.
Carol Broth with us, the author of The Entrepreneur's Equation, evaluating the realities, risks, and rewards of having your own business. She's a well-known business strategist among multinationals and solopreneurs alike, a sought-after business commentator on Fox News, MSNBC, WGN TV in Chicago, known for her smarts and irreverence. And she writes an award-winning unsolicited business advice blog at www.carolroth.com. Carol Roth, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I think one comment, one sentence really says it all. You know, are you ready to be an entrepreneur? And I guess really the questions are, is this something that you really want to do? And this is coming right from your press release, because if I look at it and think about that, there are people who have the ability, but is it really something for you? Carol, how do you make that decision? What are those first steps that you take?
I think this is a really tough question, Michael, but so many people focus on the wrong things. It's so much about, can I do this, when it should really be about, should I do this? Because just because you can do something doesn't mean you will be the most successful person to do it, and it doesn't mean it's your best opportunity as well. So you really have to take a step back and say, you know, is this what I want to do? Have I stacked the odds in my favor? And is this going to give me the best chance of success? And this is not an easy thing to accomplish. This is a preparation type of thing. This is fail to prepare, prepare to fail. So you have to take a step back and be willing to do the math before you go down the entrepreneurial path.
Carol, what makes an entrepreneur? When I say, what makes up an entrepreneur? You know, male, female, you know, it really doesn't matter. It's a business person any way that you look at it. But are there overarching themes? Are there certain basic ingredients that someone should have if they're going to take that step?
I personally think so. I think one of the first things, if you were truly going to be an entrepreneur, you have to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. Because being an entrepreneur means that you're going to be in business, and being in business means that the only thing that's certain is that nothing is certain. And so it's really, really critical that you get comfortable with that roller coaster, that you're somebody who can take on the risk and be okay with not knowing everything that's happening. But at the same time, that you're not so much of a risk taker that you haven't spent the time to prepare beforehand. So I think it's a really critical balance between the two. You don't want to be completely ready, fire, aim, but at the same time, too, you have to be somebody who can take on that risk and ride the roller coaster and still be okay with that. So it really is this fine balance between the two.
You're going to have something with inside of you, and I think you're right. There has got to be that homeostasis, that balance, because in this ultra-competitive marketplace that we have now, going into business for yourself and applying for a job, it's almost the same thing in this area. If you applied for a job 10, 15, 20 years ago, you may have three or four people that were applying for that particular job. Now what they face out there is you got 10,000 people applying for the same job. And you've got, and let's face it, nothing is new. We may have some twists on things, but nothing is new. So if you're going to start and you're going to get into that competitive environment, you're right. You better have your basics done, and you better know exactly where you're going and what you want, or you're going to be in big trouble.
Yeah, you know, I think, Michael, you must be reading a lot of my stuff because we are completely aligned on that. And I think that it's very interesting. There used to be this feeling that there was job security. And so everyone felt that they were entitled to have these jobs. And what we found out over the last couple of years is that there's no such thing as job security. So I think the ego tells a lot of people, hey, well, you can take control of your own destiny by starting your own business. But that's really a false pretense. The same skills that it takes you to woo a potential employer to hire you are the same skills required to woo potential customers to buy from you day in and day out. And if you're facing a tough job market, it's because these companies can't afford to hire lots of people because they don't have the customers patronizing the businesses, the same things that you're going to face as an entrepreneur. So I think there's a little bit of myth-busting that needs to happen in terms of that mindset, in terms of I'm going to take control of my destiny and all of a sudden be able to run this business even though I can't convince somebody to hire me.
Now, by the way, when we talk about being in control of your destiny, that in and of itself is an oxymoron because of what's going on today in the marketplace and being competitive. Now, we've got the desk and we have the computer now, and in many cases it levels the playing field even against the majors because you're dealing with something you don't have all of the overhead, so you could do it. But it's that step-by-step process of knowing what you can do. I think life in and of itself, Carol, is a process. A process is a chair. You know, you start with the legs, you get the seat, you got the back, and you have to build it from there. If you don't build it, and if you don't project, and if you don't know what you're going to do, if you fall down your first month, don't start.
Well, you know, I think that that's an interesting point, but I think you not only have to build the foundation, you have to have enough money to continue to build that foundation, because you might build the chair and realize, you know what, this isn't as comfortable as I thought. Maybe I need to build an armrest, or maybe I need to put my feet up, and you have to keep investing in that chair or investing in that business. And I think that that's one of the other critical things that people forget about, especially since technology enables it to be so easy to start these businesses. You need more than the capital to start. You have to be able to sustain the business and operate it sometimes for a couple of years while it gets that foundation, that chair underneath it, and you have to be able to live in the meantime. So if you're already in a position where you don't have a paycheck coming in because you've lost your job, and then you have to fund the business operations, it ends up being a really tricky proposition. And you never want to be in a position where you have to choose between paying your rent and investing in your business, because you're going to end up making an emotional decision. And I think that type of thought pattern doesn't come into play when people are in this emotional space.
Oh, no question about it. And as far as how much it's going to start cost to start it, it's not necessarily the startup. It's going to be 6 months ahead of time to make sure that you've got enough money as you're building, as you're growing. But for the most part today, which I think is interesting, if you and I started a business at the very same time, do you know what the difference would be between us?
The execution.
The color of the computer. There was a time.
and of course my fantastic good looks too, Michael.
Absolutely. No question about that. But the key here is when you're unless you've got video on your computer, I think that's where the key is. A lot of businesses are started on the computer today. You don't have to have stock. You don't have to have a basement full of product, because it can all be gotten from this place and that place. And I think the old days, when the difference between men and women when you're going out to start up would be the difference in attitude, certain strengths, weaknesses, etc. But in today's world, with the advent of technology, my goodness, that in and of itself put everybody up in the same place.
It does, and what it then boils down to is the marketing. Because you can have the best business behind that computer, you can have the biggest brain in the world, but unless you're able to communicate to customers, hey, come over here, close that trust gap that exists online and be able to service them, it doesn't matter if you have the best business in the world. If nobody knows about you, you don't have a business.
Oh, no question about it. You know, years ago we had that, you know, six degrees of separation. That's not so today. If you knew somebody 20 years ago, you might get 15 or 20 to 100 leads. Today, if you know how to work it right, you can get 100 million people out there listening to your message. And if your message is right, if your message hits home based on what it is that you're offering, you're going to get a lot of people to listen. And we have an e-consumer today. That consumer is so different than the consumer of years ago. This is a very wise consumer. A push of the button, they can know anything they want at any time about any product and how to get it sitting at home. So you've got to have that specialness whereby you can't sell them anymore. You have to frame it in such a way that they buy it.
Yes, and not only are they wise, they are also very fickle. They will love you and leave you if you don't really service them and don't make sure that you're telling them over and over again how important they are to your business.
Oh, sure. And by the way, Carol, that in and of itself, major businesses today, they've had to take that transition. It's not going out and getting the new client. It's servicing what you have already. And there's a collaboration that's going on with it today. That client has to become part of your business, quote unquote. I don't mean an equity owner in the business, but they have to be part of that business. And every employee that you have has to be part of that business today if you're going to succeed.
I completely agree with that. I completely agree. And those are the people who are going to go out and advocate for you, and they're your best chances of getting new clients. Because if you have raving fans within your organization as well as in your customer base, guess what? They're the ones who are going to tell their friends, tell people who look a lot like them, other businesses, and that's what's going to help you survive.
Yeah. Yeah, and I really believe that that's it. And realizing, and I think this is extremely important, what it is that you're selling or you're offering. Most people have no idea. There's an old adage that's something that I wrote down and it stayed with me for years, and I've repeated it probably 12 million times now. And that old adage is never sell the way you buy. People buy for their reasons, not ours. And most people I have watched and listened to are talking to themselves, selling to themselves, presenting to themselves without any idea that that person on the other side of that hearing cycle has a mind of their own, and they don't think the way we do. So it's also learning the customer's response, what it is that they're really looking for and how to touch them.
That's right. Every customer is tuned into their favorite radio station, which is WIIFM. What's in it for me? That's what they care about. And you really have to frame what you're offering not only in that what's in it for me, but also from a benefits perspective. Because I still think a lot of people think McDonald's sells hamburgers and french fries when it doesn't. It sells convenience, it sells value, and it sells consistency.
No question.
Those are the things that people care about.
But it takes... Let's take it a step beyond that. You know, the values and the consistency, et cetera, leads you to one other thing, some emotional satisfaction of what's going to happen after you eat it. And I think when it really boils down to it, it's how am I going to feel about it after I get it? And that, I think, is the key. And that decision is made in a millisecond on an emotional level. They recognize it. They know. Yeah.
It is, and like you said, in this crowded marketplace, when they're bombarded with messages all over the place, it's harder and harder to communicate on that emotional level.
Now, by the way, on your website, if we go to the website, I know that there are the steps to find out the where, the what, and should I really do this? And I really believe that somebody needs more time to see it as opposed to just hearing about it. Is there any kind of an evaluation that you've got on the website?
You know, we do these wonderful videos called Fired Up, which is a quick assessment to find out if you have the finances, the inspiration, the responsibilities, the experience, and the dedication and unbridled passion to see if you have what it takes to be an entrepreneur today, or perhaps if you should keep your day job. So that's something that people can head over to the website and fill out a form, and we do those videos on an ongoing basis.
Well, the website, how do we find the website? How do we find you on the website?
The website is carolroth.com, and if you just forget that and type my name into Google, I'm all over the place, very easy to connect with me, and I love to interact with people, and actually have a fantastic community that contributes frequently on my blog as well to provide a lot of information for free to entrepreneurs and small business owners.
One last question, and I think it's a critically important question, because of the issue that we're speaking about right now and the book in and of itself and what you're offering, is so critical today. There's a window of opportunity right here for anybody that truly wants it because of what's going on with the economy. Question. Is there a question that I didn't ask you that I should have that would have been brought more information up that we, the listeners, need to hear? Did we miss anything?
You know, Michael, that is a good question, and I think that the one thing that you have to think about when you approach entrepreneurship is that it's not just one question, it's a series of questions. It's about motivation, it's about time, it's about the opportunity, and it's about the person. So I think it would probably take us an entire hour to get sure. through all of those things. But I think that the most important, if we can just boil it down to one piece of all those things, is the timing piece. Just because entrepreneurship is not right for you right now doesn't mean it's not right for you never. And you can do things to stack the odds in your favor in terms of gaining more experience and getting your finances in order and making sure that the family is on board with what you're doing that will give you the best chance of success. So because it doesn't work today doesn't mean it's not a never proposition.
Now, going out and fighting the world is one thing, but if you have to go home and fight the world at home because of the fight you're putting on for the family, I think you're going to be in major trouble. One other thing before we call it a day or a night, whatever the case may be, is basically this, that you mentioned about asking, you know, many questions. But they have to be the right questions. You can have, if you ask the wrong question, you get the right answers to the wrong questions and you never get anywhere. So it's learning the right questions to ask that can put you on that track to stay focused.
It isn't. Can I add one more thing while we're on this little roll here? Is also setting your goal, because we all have different definitions of success, and so we all can't take the same path to get there. So if you don't know where it is you want to end up, you can't figure out the right road.
Love every second of it. Hey, Carol Roth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, cities and what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Bernice Armour coming up with us pretty soon. Zero to Breakthrough.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London.
Bernice Armour with us. She's the author of Zero to Breakthrough. The question, how does a 24-year-old police officer transform herself into America's first African-American female combat pilot in just 3 years? As Bernice Flygirl Armour describes it in Zero to Breakthrough, she did it by identifying her passion, her oomph, and harnessing that power of breakthrough mentality, and then taking action in a combination of planning, discipline, and persistence. And there's a bunch more. Bernice, hi, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you? I got to tell you, I'm looking at the book I have in front of me, by the way. And procrastinating when you're in the middle of a combat situation, and if you're a fighter pilot, doesn't work, does it?
No, it potentially has very lethal outcomes, and that's all seriousness. But so does procrastinating on some of our actions, even back here at home on our battlefronts. And sometimes that can be in our lives or personally or professionally. So.
Yeah, no question about it, because when you really think about it, as a fighter pilot, I mean, it could be life or death up there. But at the same time, with people with their own world, if they take time to think about it, you know, and they don't quite want to take action because of the fear factor and so on and so forth, you can destroy yourself in your own life. So let me ask you this. When you decided to, you were a police officer, when you decided to become a fighter pilot, what was it caused you to take that step? And did you know you had it within you to get it done?
And I'll just make one little statement here. I flew attack helicopters, so I didn't fly fighters. So I just, you know, I'm considered combat pilot, vice fighter pilot, which is juicier because we're down and dirty, you know, 300 feet above the ground, right, in there with the troops. And when I was making that decision to transition, honestly, Michael, it was about living an exciting, adventurous, juicy life. Several years earlier, when I was in college, I saw a black woman in a flight suit, and I thought it was just awesome. It was exciting. It was something I'd never thought of doing before. So for me, boom, another opportunity, challenge came up. And like I talk about in Chapter 1, you know, that creating the flight plan, where are you, where do you want to be, that was another flight plan that I wanted to execute. And I said, why not? And I didn't want to what if anything, you know. You only have one life.
Yeah, and by the way, and I got that wrong as far as the fighter pilot in the jet as opposed to the attack helicopter. You had it 1,000 times tougher. You're right. That's right on that's right there in the face of it.
I actually call it a roller coaster without wheels. There were some amazing experiences.
No, and I bet it is. And if that roller coaster, we have that in life anyway. And if people would get to the point of being able to deal with that roller coaster, you see, most people don't have what I'm going to say you and I have, okay? Because there's something I have that we have in common. Are you ready for this?
I am.
Semper Fi.
All right. Semper Fi, cleared hot. Semper Fi, for those that might not know out there, Semper Fidelis, always faithful. And that is one thing all Marines carry in common, and it's a bond that will never go away.
Absolutely, that's one Marine to another. But I don't want to tell you what I don't want to tell you when I was in though. This is like 200 years ago, but
I thought it was that long.
But when we really come down to it, it's that see, there was something that I learned in boot camp, and I want to apply it to this. It was that. No excuse. Move forward. If you're going to get it done, get it done and go ahead. And
absolutely.
That in and of itself, you can't find in the schools today. As a matter of fact, you can't even find any place unless you're going to get into the military that can teach you that. And it's something that's taught. The kids today are learning that there's no consequence. And if they don't get anything done, they give up, they go someplace else. So what I'm saying here is there should be courses on being able to do this. You know, even if somebody doesn't get into the military, some kind of a quote-unquote boot camp to go through, a boot camp for life to go through to be able to deal with what comes up at you.
And, you know, honestly, Michael, that's a big part of my message. You know, number one, the breakthrough mentality. So from the military standpoint, it's, you know, there are no excuses. You get it done, right? You accomplish the mission. Number two, as a pilot, you know, I was given permission to engage on targets. Unless we were just out-and-out combat, then we had that permission already. And if you think about it, as a person walking around in our life on this journey, we have the permission. And it says that on my website, clear as day. It's the biggest thing there when you get on the homepage. You have permission to engage. I'm not giving it to you. Nobody gives it to you. You have it inside, and it's up to you to clear yourself hot and pull the trigger. You know, opportunities don't go away. Other people take advantage of them. So if somebody's just going to sit back, they have to know that they're giving their opportunity away because they're not giving themselves that permission.
No, absolutely. And by the way, you hit on something strong. Over the years, I've listened to people who can't do this, they won't do this, and they're stuck on that. And when it comes down to them, they're waiting for someone else to give them permission to go live, to go get married, to go get a job, to be successful,
right,
because they can't do it themselves. And you've got it. It's right there. You want permission. The only person that's going to give you permission is the one staring back at you in the mirror.
That's exactly right. Because, you know, it's about transitioning and moving forward. And yes, we could say our country is in a huge transition. The economy, the war, you know, jobs. Now, what are we going to do about it? We're here. What are we going to do about it? And helping America accomplish her dream is all of us accomplishing our dreams together, moving forward. And that's hitting the speed bump, but continuing to roll over it anyway. It's an obstacle. You don't stop. You acknowledge, and you keep pushing forward.
Now, by the way, self-discipline is a very important, those two very important words. It's a term, and most people don't get it. And if you want to learn self-discipline, you start at the very beginning. You know, what foot do I want to put on the floor first when I get out of bed? What clothes do I want to wear? And what that does, that creates that discipline of when you say you're going to do it, you go ahead and do it. There's too many people who do not, they won't do what they say they're going to do, and they lose credibility.
And that's true. And sometimes, you know, I even fall prey to that. And, you know, what it boils down to, Michael, is your why big enough? Is your why big enough? Are you willing to do today to get the result you're looking for tomorrow? And if you want to lose 50 pounds and you keep shoving cheeseburgers in your face, then the cheeseburger was the bigger why than feeling healthier and fit and being full of life when you get to the top of the stairs instead of trying to catch your breath. You know, I did the workout once a year plan. It doesn't work. So the discipline is definitely part of it. And the umph behind that is absolutely the drive, the why. And that's creating the flight plan again. That's the foundation. Chapter one, it's the beginning. Where are you? Where do you want to be? Don't even worry about the how or how to get there, because then you're going to bog yourself down. You're going to say, oh, I can't do it. And really, it won't, right, because it's not a can't. But when you create the goal, people will show up to help you. The resources will show up.
No, I truly believe that, because when you really come down to it, people say, I have no control over their life, and they're sitting in a miserable situation. Well, guess who pulled it? You did. You hear it? I mean, you did it to yourself. So if you can do that to yourself, guess what else you can do? It's called make the transition. There's too many people living in the past. I heard a great analogy once. It's like driving down the highway of life with your hands, steering with your hands on the rearview mirror and getting into a lot of accidents because you're always looking to the past. And it's just shift, get your hands on the steering wheel, and things would be a lot better.
You know, I'm not even going to let people have an excuse after this one, because number one, what do successful people do? Number one, they don't make excuses. Number two, they make a commitment to the commitment. Number three, they execute. And I am going to be giving away free coaching, Flyby Coaching. It's a video series. People go to my website, they sign up for the newsletter, and I'm going to be shooting that out, because I want to be people's personal, and I call them my fly peeps, right? I want to be a personal coach to help you execute. Create the flight plan. The next step is to execute. And I want to help people get there. So I'm putting myself out there to help people get this going. All they have to do, go to the website, sign up, and they will get the information forwarded to them. There is no excuse. None.
I got that loud and clear. By the way, Bernice, I want to talk about something that you're involved in that I think is so critically important. It's veterans, the vets transitioning back into life in the workplace after they've been in service. There's so many things that go on with vets today. It's that, you know, there's a lot of memory loss in a lot of the vets. But the one thing that in my heart of hearts in my life, I will never understand and I will never accept why a veteran can go homeless, why a veteran can go without food, why so many things happen to the vets. Those were the people that were out there, men and women, they allowed you and I to talk today, and how dare anybody let them come back. Yeah, I don't even have the words for it.
Well, you know, there's an organization that's specifically helping homeless women vets, and not to say that women are more important or anything than men, because that's not the case. But when a woman goes homeless, she also takes her kids with her, right? FinalSaluteInc.org is an organization that is really reaching out to help homeless women veterans, and I'm so humbled to be a part of helping them you know, to get the exposure out there, because no vet should be homeless on the street, especially a vet and their kids. What can we do to push this forward? Number one, raise the exposure. Number two, donate. Number three, help them get opportunities in small business. Because I believe, you know, the unemployment rate for veterans is double that of the national average. But veterans, military folks, we're leaders. Let's start some companies that you're passionate in, right? Fill the gap that our country needs in different areas. Create our own income. And, oh, by the way, we're going to hire somebody else, and we've just created another job. That is part of the how we're going to see our way out of this.
By the way, no question about that whatsoever. And I've heard situations where we've had, you know, vets in the middle of a combat situation and somebody here is taking their home away because they didn't make the payment. See, it's I know. It's those things that I can't believe happens. If we're going to give billions, and I'm not getting political and I'm not going left or right, it doesn't really matter. But if we're going to give billions of dollars away to foreign countries to help them do this and help them do this, my goodness, do something at home. Fix the problem here and then go out and do all those things that would be wonderful. We've got people right here who need jobs, people who need help, who need homes, who need all of those things. And we're not doing the job.
It's going to be responsibility on both of our parts, honestly, Michael. Sure. So, you know, and I'm not getting into a political statement, and we hear people saying the government can't take care of everything, and we want the government to do more. Bottom line is it's not working the way it is. So, yes, can we get government to do more? Sure. And private sector, can we get them to do more and support these veterans coming home? Absolutely. And as a veteran, I want my fellow brothers and sisters to step up and say, you know what, if I can't find that job, what business am I going to create for myself? Because we create opportunities. We create an income stream for ourselves. We're good at – give us some duct tape and fishing line, right? It's like that MacGyver stuff. We will create a solution. And I'm calling all my brothers and sisters at arms that are transitioning, create the solution. And I'm here to help. And there are other veterans out there. Chuck Vollmer, the Pinnacle Five is a consulting group, the top enlisted, personnel and all of the services. We are all working together trying to figure out how to get these vets training so they can either get that job or, even better yet, create their own company and write their own paycheck.
Yeah, and by the way, this wasn't going after the government with what I was saying. I was addressing the problem in and of itself. It's a reversible cause and effect, because it's up to us. And when I say it's up to us,
That's right.
It comes down to it, we yell at the doctors because they charge too much money. Well, why do they charge too much money? Because we sue them and the prices go up. So it's reversible. It all starts with you and I. It works our way up. We're responsible for who we put in office. So it's not the government. It's the we. It's America in and of itself. We've got to have a little bit of a different mindset here.
Absolutely. A breakthrough mentality. That's what we need.
Okay. Now, and when we talk about breakthrough mentality, when you start working with people, you start at this beginning. What's the first thing you do to get them to take that first step? Because it's that first step that's the hardest step. Once you've got that, then things start to happen. But it's that first step to say, I can do this.
To create a firm foundation of harnessing the power of a breakthrough mentality really means. And the definition, simply put, is refusing to settle, even in the smallest of moments, and demanding a breakthrough life, demanding a breakthrough career, a breakthrough marriage, family, relationship, whatever it is, demanding that and knowing that you are in control of helping create some of those outcomes.
And I've
seen it personally happen in my life, and when you actually see how powerful you are to create and manifest just because of your attitude and your mentality, that changes things.
By the way, attitude, mentality are really what the key is. And an attitude, if you want to break it down and define it, is how you think, feel, or behave towards something. And
that's right.
The problems that stop us are learned responses. And my feeling is, Bernice, this: if you can learn, you can unlearn, and you can relearn. There isn't anything that you can't do if you put your mind to doing it. We still live in the greatest country in the entire world, and the one thing we still do have is the freedom of choice. And there's opportunity still here with the jobs, the rest of it. They talk about 8, 9, 10% unemployment. But that still means 89 to 90% are still employed. There is still money here, and we're still moving forward. So I wouldn't want to live anyplace else. And you can do it here. There was a time when women had it harder than men getting in a particular place and climbing the ladder. That's not so anymore, because there's always a law to open a door. So I think we're pretty much even considering what we want to do to go out and get it done. We may end up with a female president this next time around or the time after.
Hey, it could happen. Now, I will debate with you a little bit on it's just as easy for a woman as it is a guy. You know, yeah, there are still some barriers out there, but, you know, I still have that mentality. What do I have to do to go over, run, under, through? Just because it might be a little tougher doesn't mean it can't be done. Like, we still have roles in the military that women are not allowed by law to move into. And let's face it, when you're climbing up the ladder in the military to be a, you know, a colonel or a general, a lot of those slots are picked from combat arms. So if a woman can't be in combat arms, how can she take the same career course as her male counterpart? You know, and I know that's a whole other discussion, but
well, it is. But we're starting to run out of time. But let me touch on this one. There are the stuff about everybody was created equal. We're not. Some of us are bigger. Some of us are smaller. There are things you can do I can't do, and there are things I can do that you can't do. And I really believe when it comes to combat, you know, the strength of it. There are women who can do this, but who's going to pick me up and throw me over their shoulder and drag me out and get me to a safe place? So there's areas that it does work, and there's areas that it doesn't work. And I think that as far as the looking at someone climbing the ladder, quote unquote, where they come from, what job they did should have nothing to do with where they're going to go.
Absolutely. And as far as the pulling, you know, your partner, because there were guys that I could pick up and the same other guys couldn't pick me up. So I think if we're going to do that kind of standards, it should be based on the standards. If you can pull the load and pick up the weight, then you can do the job. If you can't, then you can't, and you're not qualified,
but
male
Bernice,
or female.
You know what I call anybody who can pick me up and throw me around? Sir.
Fly girl?
Sir. we're about ready to go. Let me ask you this. The website we can find you at and find out what you're doing.
VerniceArmor.com. V as in Victor, ErniceArmour.com. And there everyone can find the links to my Facebook, my Twitter, YouTube. They can sign up for the Cleared Hot Times and have access to the free coaching as well. That is my clear call to action. I want people to engage. Go Cleared Hot and start out by engaging with me so I can help them create that flight plan and execute.
Fly girl, go get them.
Cleared Hot.
Good night.
Good night.
If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are smaller. Say it's me that you adore from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Michael Talley with us. He's got a background in engineering, industrial sales, product management. But the most important thing is he's created the Drug Test Consultants of Pennsylvania to work with parents and their children. And we're going to get into the story. Michael, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. It's a critical issue that we're dealing with right now because there are so many drugs on the street. Michael, when I was in junior high school and high school, it was about the 11th grade where marijuana was just starting to be accepted. We didn't have the strength and the type of drugs that kids have today. And so I knock on wood and feel very lucky that I didn't have to go through all that and didn't have the temptations that a lot of the kids have. That said, but we live in a completely different world today, and drugs are easy to get a hold of, and we know what will happen if somebody, you know, overuses or uses. So let me ask you this. Let's start from scratch and lay a base. What was it that caused you to get into this and create the drug test consultants?
Well, unfortunately, it was my daughter, and my wife had passed away when my kids were 11, 12, and 16. And I stayed at home for a couple of years to take care of her and take care of the kids, but eventually had to go back into the corporate world. I got a call when my youngest daughter was a senior in a private high school, sent her to a private high school because I thought that would be good, that would be safer, not necessarily the truth. I got a call December 23rd that one of my daughter's friends had turned her in. They opened her locker and they found 10 packets of heroin. And at that time, I had no idea about drugs. I didn't know what I was doing. You can imagine, totally shocked. I put her into a rehab, a detox for 5 days on Christmas Eve. And then when she came out, I thought, she's fine. She's cured. The problem was they expelled her from school. They eventually took her back into school and she did graduate. But as time went on, I found out later that she had started using marijuana when she was 12. And you hear a lot of talk, marijuana is not a gateway drug. Marijuana is a gateway drug.
Yeah.
Everybody that uses a harder drug started with marijuana. And I'll debate that point with anybody. Today she's 30. She'll be 31 in 2 weeks. Still not working, not using heroin, but still using pills off and on to relax her. And the difference and the point I want to make to everybody that's listening is it's like the sliding door theory. You have a chance to make sure your kids grow up properly. They learn about drugs. You watch what they're doing. You get to know their friends. My option with my youngest daughter is now she's really no place. She hasn't accomplished anything. She doesn't feel like she's accomplished anything. And that even makes it worse on them. Then they feel guilty. They feel they have to use. She's been through every rehab within the three-county area. And that only works if the person that's using wants it to work. She OD'd 7 times that I'm aware of. That did not seem to scare her. We had a scare here a couple years ago in the Philadelphia, New Jersey area where they were mixing fentanyl with heroin. And we had recordings of about 130 people that died using that. You think that would scare them? What it does, it just causes people to go to that area and find out what's so strong. How do I get this? This is great. The first time they use heroin, and I learned all this through experience and doing what I'm doing and talking to my daughter and unfortunately some of her friends, they get this apparently incredible rush, and they keep trying to achieve that same rush. That's how they go from using one pack to 10 packs. That's how they go from being normal to overdosing and almost dying because they'll never achieve that, and they think they have to take more and more in order to get back to that high, and it'll kill them before they get there. And the kids
Michael,
don't
let me,
know
let
that
let me
mixing
this
certain
question.
Drugs can cause your heart to stop. It can just, it'll kill you.
Sure. Michael,
and
let me ask you this question.
If I knew
because
then what I know now, I think I could have been a factor. I would have looked at my kids, checked them, watched for signs and symptoms, possibly drug tested them at home. So many things you can do, you need to do. I'll give you a quick example. I was doing a flea market once for a high school that was to benefit their post-prom party. And I was at the booth, and as you can imagine, everybody walks a wide girth around the booth. Nobody wants to come over and talk about home drug testing and alcohol testing and what you can do to protect your kids. I stepped away from the booth, and this woman came along with what I thought was a 16-year-old kid. And she looks at the drug test in the literature and starts laughing and says, if you can't trust your 16-year-old kid, who can you trust? And there's the crux of the problem. Parents want to be friends. They don't want to be parents. You have to. I know that now, and I can say it because I made that mistake. You have to be a parent to watch your kids. You have to get to know their friends. I'm kind of going on and on. Does that answer the question?
That's it. I wanted to stop you and ask you a question because something came up that I was thinking about. There's obviously got to be a disconnect with your daughter. Somewhere the value is not there, because obviously, Michael, the value for doing this, if it's better than the value for doing that, we do the this. I mean, just to put it simply. When your wife died, your daughter was what, 11, 12 years old?
Yes.
Okay. Did that have anything to do with her continuing on with the drugs, the something that she didn't want to face? Has she addressed that at all? Because I think it's critical, and it would take you back, 10, 15 years ago or so. I was doing an interview with a doctor who had gone to one of the African countries, and they were dealing with the AIDS epidemic. And he was saying, well, we need education, we need money for this and that, whatever. And I said, education's not going to do it. Because I said, how old do these kids live? He said, well, they live to be 20, 22 years old. There's nothing to look forward to. There's no schools. There's no education, et cetera, professions. So why not go out and get AIDS? What do you have to worry about if you're going to die in a few years anyway? That said, the value wasn't there. They had nothing to look forward to. And every once in a while, when there's that kind of disconnect and you tie it into something that happened in the family, I guess the real question was, and I don't want to get real personal with this, but the real question with this is, was that ever addressed with her?
Yeah, it was addressed, and she continually says that her mother passing away wasn't the reason. Between the two of us and what I've seen, I think the reason is, and this is just my educated guess, it's the friends they get involved with. You know, I was so busy trying to keep everything going and putting all three kids in school, and I think you miss certain things. That's why the family unit is so crucial and important. You need a mother and a father. You've got to be able to watch the kids. You have to see what they're doing, and you have to watch and know their friends. And I think I made the mistake of, yeah, she's busy. She must be happy. She's got friends. Didn't really notice her friends were changing a lot. New friends this week, different friends from last week. She liked going into the city. The friends, in my mind, the friends are the crux of the problem. You need to know your kids' friends, their parents, and you've got to talk to each other about what they're doing. And I've had people in my neighborhood say, yeah, I knew she was doing something wrong, but I didn't want to tell you. And I'm saying, why not?
Yeah.
I needed to know this. It could have saved my daughter. So I think that and you're probably right, there are obviously very specific values that need to be taught too, and possibly I didn't do that. You know, I can't look back and say I did, because it wouldn't be fair.
Sure.
But I think a lot of it is their friends, their lifestyle, what they do.
Yeah, and you can't get guilty about it. And the reason I'm saying is, if she wouldn't have found that, she would have found something else. I mean, you take a look at, you got, you know, all the kids, you got a lot on your plate, your wife's not there, you got to be mom and dad, etc. You can't see it all, and I wish
no.
we could, but you can't see it all. And my goodness, the one thing that your daughter is responsible for is the legacy that you're creating to help other kids not getting into that kind of a mess, or if they are in it, you know, a way to work their way through. So your daughter gave a great gift to this world. When she cleans up, then it'll be time for her to do it. But right now, the legacy is very powerful, and I'm not even sure if she realizes that.
Well, I want her to take over the business someday. I want her to be able to talk to people, because I come across parents all the time. I had a parent bring their child in a little while ago thinking she was using marijuana. And that was a surprise to them. They had no idea. It turns out she's using heroin.
Mm.
That's it. The kids are using 2 years typically before the parents find out that they're using. You cannot be too careful. You can't be afraid of your kids. You have to start talking to them. When they get into middle school, you mentioned a while ago that 11th grade marijuana started popping up. It pops up in middle school today.
Yeah.
It's peer pressure. They're there, and all of a sudden, they're into a whole new world. Instead of being one out of 32, they're one out of maybe 1,000 in this middle school, which is much bigger. They're not prepared for this peer pressure unless the parents talk to them about drugs, about what can happen. It's one of the reasons I like parents to do the home testing for drugs. It's a very, very easy excuse for the child to say, I can't use anything. My parents test me. Removes the peer pressure, and it takes them out of that situation where if you do one shot or hit of heroin, you're an addict, and you don't recover from that kind of addiction. You can learn to get it under control, but you're always an addict for life. And the difference is having a daughter that's 30 years old who is not really enjoying her life the way she should. And my other two girls are a couple years older. You know, they have a normal life. They've achieved things. They're happy. They're working. They have houses. That's what you want for your child. You don't want them to suffer. And it just gets out of your reach at some point in time. You can't do anything about it.
One of the things that I just absolutely don't understand, Michael, and there's no way I will ever understand it, why the state of California made marijuana legal with a doctor's prescription. I don't get this. And it is a gateway drug. I don't care what anybody says. We know better than that. You start with this, you move to something else, and then you're on the road. And we know the story. It's an old story. But the point of contention is they're allowing this to happen in California, you know, and it spreads to other states. And when they make it okay to do that, then the marijuana, and you said it earlier, the gateway drug, is not enough. And if you want to hide yourself in marijuana, you can hide yourself in heroin. Heroin hides you a little bit better. Every addict that I've ever talked to that has come back, people who've gone to the alcohol and drugs, etc., and they're recovering. Well, when they recover, it's always the same thing. There was something that they were hiding, something that they didn't feel that they had and they couldn't deal without the drug. And that in and of itself, I think, there's a sadness, because that, we're going to lay that one on the culture. And not even mom and dad, on the culture. You have a society that subscribes to a basic set of rules, and then the culture within that are the ones who act out those rules. It is the culture that dictates it. And go back to the kids, the friends, peer pressure. If you're not doing it, you're not one of us. But she's going to draw, or he's going to draw too, those people who do that. So when we talk peer pressure, we seek them out. We find them, because now we've got something in common. We're accepted, and we find identity with them.
Yeah, and the medical marijuana, just like you say, is the most ridiculous thing they could ever have done. And they leave it in the same form that you would get if you smoked it. It's not like taking opiates and turning them into Vicodin, Percodan, Percocet, something that people would use for pain for after surgery. It's a different form. It's not the type of thing you would expect. But they're having it out there, and everybody is looking at it and thinking, oh, well, it's, you know, you can take it for glaucoma or nausea for a cancer problem.
Yeah.
So it must be okay. The doctors are prescribing it. Nah, there's nothing wrong with using that. And it just gives such a bad and wrong impression in people's minds. And in kids, too, what are they supposed to think? We have 14 states plus D.C. that are approving medical marijuana. That's ridiculous. It should not be used. And I think the government has to take a stronger hand in stopping this from coming across our borders.
Well, Michael, we're talking a lot of money here. When I say we're talking a lot of money, there's people on this side of the border that are making a tremendous amount of money from that, those drugs that are coming across. And one of the things that could totally stop it is if we stop using it, but we don't stop using it. And I have to say we, because we're all in this thing together, whether you physically use it or you don't use it. And we're as responsible for those cartels that come across the border, because they wouldn't bring it across if somebody wasn't spending money on it once it got here. And when we have the President of the United States, like him, dislike him, it doesn't matter, saying that, well, our borders are fine, there's nothing happening, and we're watching what's going on with the drugs coming across and the human trafficking and the rest of it, you know, thank goodness for Arizona and states like that that say enough of this stuff, and we're going to do what we can to do to stop this. And it's not just somebody illegal coming to this country. It's what they're doing once they get here. There's the problem. You want to be, you want to come from another country? Come from another country. We all have relatives who did. My dad came from Russia in, what was it, the early 1900s. But the point of contention is there is a joint responsibility of why this is going on. It's not just the kids. It's you. It's I. You're doing a job. So, you know, applause for you. But it's you, it's I, it's everybody out there that's an American that has to get this stuff stopped. We stop buying it, they stop selling it.
I couldn't agree more. You got Napolitano out there, you have the president saying that everything is fine. It's not fine.
No.
There are people that are getting killed over here in automobile accidents, and somebody is here illegally. I'm the same way. My parents came over, my father came over in the late 20s, but he came over the proper way.
Yeah.
Nobody's trying to break out of the United States. People are trying to get in. And there's a reason for it, but we're minimizing that reason by allowing all this to go on. And you're right, we've got to stop using drugs before the flow is going to stop. And it's not an easy situation, but we have to do it one by one, and I just want to do it by talking to parents get them to talk to her kids, drug test the child, give the kid a reason not to use. We can all do something to make sure that we do as much as possible to not only eliminate it, but minimize it at least, eliminate it at best.
Yeah, Michael, I think
destroying it kills brain cells. Every drug you use, marijuana kills brain cells. Somebody smoking marijuana for 2 years, it's not as smart as they should be. And again, people resist that. It kills brain cells. It's a gateway drug.
It starts also in the schools. When I say starts in the schools, you talk about Detroit, 25-30% dropout rate. I mean, across country, there is a major dropout rate. So if you're going to drop out, then the value for not going to school is greater than the value for going to school. So if you've dropped out, for the most part, this obviously isn't black and white, and this is how it's going to be solid. But if you dropped out, then you go to where somebody's going to accept you. It could be a gang. It could be anything. That's where the stuff with the drugs start. It's got to start with some dignity. It's got to start with valuing yourself, and that has got to start at home. Then it has to go to the schools, and then it moves forward from there. Right now, we don't have it in a lot of the homes. We don't have it in a lot of the schools. And what are these kids supposed to do? Well, they just go do what they do, and then the problems start. And they don't realize consequence. They're too young to truly realize consequence. I'll bet any amount of money, if you could get your daughter to be totally neutral and you sat down with her and you say, if you knew what you knew now and the way your life is going now, would you have started this? You would probably get a very interesting answer.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the few times that she's been totally sober, she looks at her friends and decides, why am I friends with these people? I don't need to be. But it removes your inhibitions and your motivation. And the longer somebody uses drugs and the earlier they start, that steals away from their maturity. You don't mature when you're using when you're 12 years old or 15 years old.
No.
And you need parents to take care of you and set you straight. The kids want this.
So Michael, there's a competitive thing also, too. You know, you've got this job market out there. You know, we talk about the 8, 9, 10% of unemployment. But when you get to the kids, you're talking about 25-35% unemployment. And if I'm going to get offered a couple $1,000 a week to be a runner, that's got to look awfully good to compare to, you know, work for $5-6 an hour if I can get a job. So you've got that going also. There's so many issues and areas of this that we have to really address to fix it. It's not just one thing. And that's why, you know, thank goodness, thank God you guys are out there doing what you do.
Well, it's an interesting point you bring up because I do work with companies also, and I established drug testing programs and random testing. As a quick example, before we run out of time, I did a company several years ago, and I went down there and I did all the collections myself. And out of the first 58 people, keeping in mind they knew for 6 weeks I was coming, out of those 58 people, 13 tested positive for marijuana and or cocaine, and they knew it was coming. It's incredible. They do
didn't
not
care.
Stop.
Didn't care. No consequence.
No.
So what? Yeah. And I think there's
more and more companies
problems.
Are drug testing, and it's making it very difficult for a lot of these kids to get jobs.
I'll give you the example, and this is the what it is right now. I was a scrappy kid. My mom was only 5 foot tall, and she passed away in 93, so she brought us up. There was four of us, just, and she did it all by herself. I could not think of using a four-letter expletive to her in that house, and the back of the hair curls on the back of my neck, thinking what would have happened to me. You don't have that today. You don't have the respect.
No, you don't, and it's a shame because that's necessary. I never would have thought of backhawking my father or my mother.
Oh, no way.
I put that in the back of my head.
Yeah.
And you don't do that. It's your parents. My God, respect your parents.
But if you put a dent in the back of a kid's head today, you go to jail.
Yeah. And the kid knows that.
Yeah. That's that is the major problem. You know, Michael, we're going to have you come back on the air. Let's keep track of what's going on because I think this is an issue that we have to deal with and everybody needs to know the what of it, and maybe there's some people you can't stop, but maybe there are some people you can stop before it actually happens. Michael, website we can find you at?
www.drugtestofpa.com, and I put the book together along with my partner in Maryland, and that's www.omnidrugscreening.com. And there's information there to contact if anybody wants to talk about it. I'd be more than happy to discuss it with them.
Great. Michael Talley, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Oh, thank you, Michael. I appreciate your efforts, too, and you have a good night.
Good night. Present as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray, and Nancy Vincent's with us. She's the co-author of Tuning In, Simple Rituals for Everyday Living. She's a much sought-after spiritual motivator, a corporate communicator, a workshop leader, and she's a coach. She's been a media fixture for 30 years now. And let us say, Nancy, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. I'm happy to be here.
Now, in today's world, spiritualism, I've noticed that there's so many people now that are getting frightened of traditional religion, and they're moving into themselves, and they're going out probably for the first time, as many people are, and saying there's something else, and I'm not sure what it is, but the search, quote-unquote, is on. And when you talk about shamanism, which was a little surprise to me years ago, people think shaman, you think, American Indian, but it's not. You know, you can go to Europe, you can go to Asia, and you can find this spirituality, this way of practicing your life all over the world. So let's start this way. Let's talk shamanism, and let's say, where was it that you first came in contact, and when did you realize it would become such a part of your life?
Well, I guess if you go all the way back to 1971, like many people, I read Carlos Castaneda's book, The Teachings of Don Juan, and that set me afire. I said, my gosh, I've been in theater all this time because it was magical, but here's real magic. So that's how I became interested in the path. But I actually started being personally involved with shamanism in 1981 and pursued it and have pursued it since then, studying and traveling and sitting in circle and ritual with teachers around the world. I've been very lucky to have indigenous teachers from Africa, Peru, Ireland, Australia, Mexico. So it's really been a very enriching experience, and it's my teachers that I actually have to honor and who have really been the impetus for the work I do now.
And now, by the way, shamanism and the Kabbalah are very much in tune together.
Well, they are and they aren't. They both have to do with aspects of the mystical aspects that are beyond our
normal way of looking at the world, let's say. But shamanism is really very, very practical. It's the world's oldest healing technology. It's at least 40,000 years old. And it is characterized by the ability of the shamanic practitioner to enter into what's called non-ordinary reality. And in that state of non-ordinary reality, she or he accesses what's called the upper and the lower world. They travel to gain information, knowledge, and healing for the client in this modern world, or in the older societies, it could be for an individual, or it could be for the whole community.
You know, spirituality was a very interesting thing for me about, oh, it had to be, what, 30, 35 years ago. 10, 15 years before I was born, obviously. 30, 35 years ago, I'm out on the beach. I'm in California. I was brought up in Southern California. And I'm on the beach, and I'm it's a gorgeous night. The stars are, it must have been 1.5 million stars out that night. And I'm laying out there on the beach, and it's a warm night. It's just as gorgeous as it could possibly get. And I'm looking up at the stars, and I started to think with my linear mind. I started to think, well, gee, what's beyond that? Well, wait a minute. There can't be anything beyond that. It's got to stop someplace. And then how does it stop? And then I got to the point where I scared myself that night because I got beyond what I was able to fathom. And then what it made me think of was, well, if this is the unmanifested, if this is the unexplainable, how do people explain God? How do people explain the unexplainable? How do you tie things up into laws and say this is the way things work when it goes way beyond what our knowledge is? And I would love to be the knowledgeable enough to know it all, but I'm not, and I'm not anywhere near it. But that, I'll never forget that night. It really scared me. It really got me to think, which stayed with me for all of this time, that how do you define the undefinable? How do you put a label on an unmanifested something?
Well, and that's very true. You've hit the nail right on the head in that you can't articulate it. If you could quantify or define something that is awesome and awful at the same time, then it would no longer be that way. So there has to be something. There's always something that is greater. It's like Robert Browning said, a man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? And this is a very similar kind of thing. One of the nice things about shamanism is that it's not a belief system. It's based on personal experimentation to find out what works, what will heal, what kind of information can I glean from my own practice, and then what has worked over 40,000 years has stayed with us, and obviously things that haven't worked are not around anymore.
Yeah, Nancy, it's a transition from understanding and believing to knowing, and that knowing is something you can't even explain what that is, but there's something inside of you that you know when it is. And when we take a look at the billions of planets out there, and I got to say billions, there's got to be more life than just one place. It just wouldn't make any sense. Science means you prove something, but it wouldn't make any sense if we were the only place in the entire multitude of universes where there was any kind of life that thought. So that said, it would make it very hard to really fathom that what we think and we feel based on what we've been taught is where it stops. It doesn't stop there. Who knows where it's going to go, but it doesn't stop there. And I would venture to guess that most people have had that experience to some degree in their life. The only thing that bothers me, I have one thing, that we can get into ritual and we can get into, you know, ceremony and all of those things. It's discerning which of it is real. There are people who go out and spend their money, and like the people who died in the sweat rooms. So you got to be able to define what's real and what's behind that person creating it for you. There's where my only concern is, because I really believe that we were, everything you're talking about, we were that way 40,000 years ago. And whatever happened to protect ourselves, we moved away from it, and people are starting to move back now because of the direction this world is taking.
Yes, I totally agree with you on all counts that people are moving back toward a desire for personal spirituality. And you also do need to be very cautious about who you hang out with, so to speak, in that kind of a realm. And, you know, the best thing I think that you can do is really to learn to trust yourself, not to give over your power, your authority, your knowing, your intuitive knowing, to somebody who is charismatic, who seems to know more than you do, or whatever. You can learn, certainly, that, and there are wonderful teachers out there, but ultimately it comes down to checking it out for yourself. Does this feel right? Does this, do I have real confidence in this person, or am I just sitting here sort of being a blank slate for him or her to write on?
Yeah, there's a certain religion out there today that, and let me say this before I talk about it. It's the it's something that I've noticed when, I don't care what the subject matter is, when people get in trouble, when people can't be in a relationship, when people can't be here, can't be there, gangs and so on and so forth, it all boils down to somebody's ability to recognize being accepted. If you do not get accepted in the family, you're going to go out someplace else. Where you're accepted, you identify with. Hitler did it during the Second World War. They were going through what we're going through right now, and what he did with the basic population, he gave them identity. For identity, we go out and kill. We saw what happened. So my concern is that if people do not realize what they're looking for, is it spirituality or some place that somebody will accept me and it would allow me to create and manifest this identity? There is a particular religion, if you want to call it that right now, that believe in outer space beings. And you get in there and you pay for level one and you become overtaken by a space being, and then you go pay more money for level number two until you get up, you know, you work your way up under the guise of religion. People belong to it and they will die for it. Why? Because they belong and there's identity. I think that's one of the biggest problems that people have when they find something, shamanism, whatever the case may be, where you have something that's true, something that really works, and it is. And then they get afraid, so they run back to a place where they think they can be accepted someplace else. Because realistically, I think when you're dealing with spirituality, your relationship to anything begins inside of you. And what you're lacking or you have is going to manifest itself with the people that you're around and the things that you do.
Yes, well, that is certainly true. And it's just like your experience with the stars. I mean, it started within you, and then you expanded into it, so to speak.
Sure.
And I think that it's difficult to become grounded in oneself, obviously, if you feel insecure, if you don't feel comfortable with yourself. And then there's a lot of personal healing that needs to occur before you can take the next step. And I'm not saying that religion is necessarily bad. I don't want to put an either or kind of label on it. And in fact, one can be a very good Catholic, Buddhist, Jew, Protestant, it doesn't matter, and a shamanic practitioner at the same time. They're not mutually exclusive.
No. By the way, absolutely, there's no question about it. And I really believe when you talk about being a shamanic practitioner, you're just talking about living a good, clean, full life and knowing yourself. And I think knowing yourself is one of the most important things that you can do. We run through life. I have to say we as a culture, we as a society, we run through life unsure about everything. And because we're unsure, we'd rather be unhappy then be unsure, because if you find something that you might, it might or might not work for you, that's scary to do for a lot of people. So that self-assuredness just comes from living, getting knocked down, getting back up again, getting knocked down, and then realizing that, oh, well, every time I got knocked down, I gained something out of it. I grew in some way, shape, or form. And the prize that you get out of it is you get to get knocked down someplace else so you can grow some more.
Well, yes. and hopefully you gather a little wisdom along the way and perhaps don't get knocked down the same way again.
It's the wisdom that you grow with when you get knocked down, the breakup of a relationship, somebody passing away, not getting what you want in a job. If you just relax for a while and let yourself breathe into it, quote unquote, then you realize that there was a reason that it happened, and there was a growth in there for you. And in sorry for the loss, but in some way, shape, or form, if you really take a look at it, it's transitioned, it's transferred into you to be stronger, to go out and do some good in this world.
Well, and that's where ritual can be a very important element in the learning process, in the grounding process, in basically cohering, making sense out of something that's happened, and perhaps pointing the way to something better.
Sure. And by the way, there's always an answer out there for anything. I'm going to make a statement. Ask me if I know everything. Go ahead, ask me.
Do you know everything, Michael?
Absolutely, because I know how to pick up a phone and find out what I'm lacking. See, we have the access to learn to know anything that there is to know if you want to know it. You know in your heart about shamanism, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So if I wanted to know, what would I do? I would call you and I'd say, teach me. So that's the whole point. We know everything. And the things that we don't think that we know, go find out. Go find somebody and you'll get taught. That's the gift that we have in this country, in this world. There's always somebody to be able to fulfill that disconnect, somebody to link you up with where you need to be.
Yes, and they need to be someone that you trust and who's not going to be a flim-flam artist or try to usurp your own personal power, as we've spoken about earlier.
Sure, but it's called trust yourself. You see, I don't have to, and I say this lovingly and respectfully, Nancy, I don't have to trust you. I trust me. And that in and of itself works really well. That's what the learning process will do to somebody. It's called trust yourself. You don't need to trust anybody else.
Because absolutely.
If you can emotionally handle what comes your way, what more can you ask for?
Right, right. No, that's absolutely, absolutely true.
I'm going to give you, and I've done this on the air a couple times, but I'm going to give you my definition of a strong woman. You ready?
I'm ready.
Let me ask you what a strong woman is.
A strong woman is one who knows herself, who can stand in her own person and feel comfortable in her own skin, who has vision and acceptance at the same time, and compassion.
Okay, ask me what a strong woman is.
What is a strong woman?
Funny you should ask that question. Someone, I got to think of a way to say this. So someone you can walk up to and say, you know, you're a real rear end head. How's that? That was a nice way to put it. And she looks at you and say, yeah, and I'm good at it.
Well, that's definitely a part of it. Yes,
that's power in that. Absolutely, there's power in that. It's that when you know yourself, it doesn't matter what anybody thinks.
Right.
And I think that's part of also shamanism, isn't it? Knowing yourself.
Knowing yourself and being willing to let go of what you know, so that you can know more.
Yeah. No, totally agree. We're just about out of time. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. It's www.wisdomtracks.com.
Okay, I thought that was a good way of saying rear end head. I'm going to have to write that one down.
I like that. I like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we can say that, and it's not an insult on the air.
No, it isn't, and it gives you pause to think about what you actually mean.
Absolutely. Hey, Nancy Benson, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated the time. Again, one more time, please, with the website.
www.wisdomtracks.com.
Great. Nancy, hey, thanks a lot, and good night.
Thank you, Michael. Bye-bye.
Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me. I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Dresser After Dark. Kathy Puckett up next.
I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Kathy Puckett, well, there's Dr. Kathy Puckett. I can't even say that, Kathy. Can I start over again? I'm going to get profiled, aren't I? Boy, I just blew that intro like you wouldn't believe. Let me start over again.
That's okay. That's okay.
He said, okay, let me just do that. I want to make sure we get this. The co-author of Homeland Insecurity, former FBI psychological profiler in the counterterrorism unit. How is that for just
That's
getting it right?
That's just very smooth and cool. Yeah.
Yeah. When I started to say Puckett, I went blah, blah, blah.
Not the first time that's happened.
I know. I can't help it. Someday I'll get around. I'm going to write a book someday, and the book's going to be, the title of the book is going to be, Now That I've Blown the Intro, Let's Get On With the Interview.
But it loosens everything up, doesn't it? It's so nice.
It certainly does. You know, and then I have to take 3 hours to come back and then call my shrink and take those pills.
Well, I'm sorry to cause you to do that.
Oh, that's okay. How many people do you know in your life that said, Kathy, I take pills because of you.
Gosh, I don't think anybody's ever said pills, but I have had a few people say I had a few stiff drinks after talking to you.
I got that one. There is so much going on. I don't even know where to start today.
I know. I'm really curious as to I had a question for you, and it's a political question. I was wondering what you thought about, because I know that you've interviewed, you know, former governor, Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. You thought very highly of her, and that she's obviously, you know, really, you know, champing at the bit to be in this next election. What are your thoughts on Mitt Romney with respect to that same thing?
I don't feel any strength in him. You know, and I would.
Isn't that interesting?
You know who I really like? I like the governor of Texas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
No, I mean, there's strength there. There's a leader there.
Feisty.
Feisty is a good word, yes. And I would love to see Chris Christie, if they can talk him into it, from New Jersey. What we need today is and forget who we have or who we've had, it doesn't matter. We need, especially in today's world, we need a very decisive leader.
Well, you know, the reason I asked you that question was because I don't know if you remember, but we have been talking for a long time
on your show, Dresser After Dark, and you know we were talking before the last election in 2008.
Yeah.
And do you know that at that point, this was early in the campaign, you had discussed that you thought that Mitt Romney was a very, very good candidate.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting is what's happened since, because I think that what you just said about his strength as a political candidate in this next election doesn't feel like it's there. And what is it that's different about him than you thought in 2008?
Kathy, it's just a feeling. You know, I've watched him.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, there's a something there that wasn't
missing.
There. And I think one of the things that we run into now, there are some people who would be wonderful, you know, to run both sides of the aisle, you know, Democrat, Republican. Wonderful, but look what you have to go through if you're going to run. They're going to rip you apart. They're going to find what you had for dinner when you were 3 years old. And if you went to the bathroom outside of the house, they're going to bust you for it, okay? It's not right. It's not right. And
well, the battle that people have to wage to win that office is so cruel and so unrelenting and so unreasonable that I'm amazed anybody has any energy left after the election to govern, which is why I think everybody's so shell-shocked usually at the beginning of every administration.
Now, and I'm going to go back to something you and I have talked about within the last few years, and it basically is this. The example, your kid walks up to you and you say, tell the truth, and the kid tells the truth and you go, whack, okay?
Right, right.
What is the lesson? The lesson is if I tell the truth, I'm going to get hit and you're not going to vote for me. That's the same thing that happens with some of our politicians today. The other thing that's happening is I've watched in some of the town hall meetings that they're forgetting, some of them are forgetting who is working for who. That is a major problem.
There's a real kind of elite status that these people, you know, join this elite club, and then they lose touch with the people who actually believe in the ideas that they're supposedly for. You know, it's really interesting, Michael, when you were saying, you know, that there's a lack of response, or what did you just say that kind of hit something with? It's reinforcement. What in psychology, you know, what you operant conditioning and everything else, and in behavioral psychology has shown for a long time that people are, you know, their conditioning works. It works in athletic training. It also works in you know, just about everything you can name. You condition yourself, and you move to a standard, and you operate according to what gets you most of what you want, right?
Yeah.
Well,
no, absolutely.
Most of
yes.
what they want is power, is political power.
I don't think they start that way, though. Kathy, I don't think that they start...
Exactly. That's very, very true, Michael. I agree with you. I don't think they start that way. I think many of them start altruistically.
Yeah. And anybody who says, I am tired of it, I am angry, I don't like what's going on, I'm mad, I'm going to fix it, don't vote for them because they don't understand the system.
Exactly. And, you know, It's interesting, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, we cited it in our book, Homeland Insecurity. It's still a very, very pertinent, you know, movie, the points that it makes. It's like this, you know, naive but very impassioned and idealistic young congressman goes to Congress and ends up, you know, trying to fight City Hall, and they assure him over and over again that all he has to do is relax and go with the flow and let them do what they've always done. And he refuses to do that. And in the movies, of course, it has a happy ending. And, of course, in real life, we just get that over and over again.
Wait, let me jump in because there's one thing that we're not saying here. I want to make sure this point gets across. And the moment that he is doing what he thinks is right, they're out to destroy him.
Absolutely. They go after him because now he is a danger to their power.
Yeah, and by the way,
he's a danger to the status quo.
Yeah, we see that constantly, and one of the things that I do not understand, I will not understand. Yeah, I know why, but I'll say it that way. I don't understand, is we give billions to foreign countries to do certain things, and we are in such a mess here that I don't get it. We're broke, and yet we give money away. this is something that I will never in my heart of hearts understand. You take care of your own first. You create what we need to create here to survive, to make it.
Well, the and United States has had a very, very complicated... Yeah.
Well,
I'm sorry
okay.
to interrupt you, Michael.
No, go ahead.
The United States has had a very, very complicated international relations history ever since, since World War II. I mean, sure. World War I was just a taste of it, but since the Second World War, when we stepped up and took control of extraterritorial matters, you know, outside our own country, we reaped the whirlwind. The previous empires, like the British Empire and the Spanish, you know, Empire and everything, you know, the Persian Empire could have testified to the fact, the Roman Empire, keeping affecting things outside your own country is expensive and it can ruin you.
Well, very expensive, but I think what the problem is, go back to Clinton. Clinton, in his time as president, the budget was balanced. As a matter of fact, we had there was a couple hundred million surplus. We weren't owing money. Where they got it, I have no idea. What I really think happened is that Social Security lockbox got tapped into, got put into the general fund, and then dispersed and spent.
Understood that either. I've never understood why they say that, you know, and first of all, I don't really understand. I don't really know if they understand what a balanced budget is, because I think, you know, it's not being in the red, and I don't think we've ever been not in the red, have we?
We were in the Clinton.
The government's always in the red.
Yeah, but no, in the Clinton era, we were. We were, and I'm saying that as a right of center Republican here.
Because we talked about this last week.
Yeah,
you mentioned this last week. But you know, it is true though that it was a Democratic administration, and you were, you know, you pointed that out. But the thing is also that Clinton did not have troops on the ground in two wars.
Yeah, well, okay, but let's take this. Let me move this forward, and that's very true. And I'm not just passing that off. That I want to touch on. We'll make a note for next week. What I want to touch on here, basically, is that we buy goods from China. China takes the money and reinvests back into us. So in essence, what we're doing is we're taking our own money and we're giving it to somebody to give back to us, and now we're in debt like we wouldn't believe. Then we get into a situation where we're going to give Brazil, a couple of $1 billion to go out and drill offshore oil. And the president said, we'll be more than happy to give you the money so you can create and do whatever, and we'll be happy to be one of your customers. You heard him say it a couple of weeks ago. The problem is as bad as the economy is, as much trouble as we are, what are we giving them a couple of $1 billion for to drill? When we have to borrow it from China, and then when we borrow it from China, not only do we have to pay the principal back, but there's huge interest on top of the principal.
Let me point something out. We, whether we like it or not at this point, are part of a global economy.
No question.
The drilling for oil off of Brazil is going to involve all kinds of U.S. interests. That will involve U.S. technology and jobs that people from here will be involved in that industry, in developing that industry. So that's one thing, is that they will globalize that way. Another thing is that South America has been a very quiet corner of the world for a long, long time, but there are all kinds of, I don't know if you're aware, there's a geographical area there, which is almost... the Wild West, as far as not only drug cartels but international terrorist groups. It's kind of a free for all down there. Securing the national interest by developing strong allies in South America is a good idea right now.
Now, by the way, I'm going to give you a yes, but not a resounding yes. My concern is. And you know I love you. Okay. Not a resounding yes, but there are so many problems here. We have so much so much oil here untapped. We've got it in Texas. We've got we've got it up around the Great Lake region towards Canada. Canada's got oil. Mexico is totally untapped. And we're worrying about jobs and people are losing their houses, and there are people who can't eat. We have veterans who don't have homes and are starving out there. There was one vet, my sister's daughter. He's been in the Army, and he's been in 17 years. He's got 3 more years to retirement. He's talked to me about people who were going to lose their homes because the what is this garbage when we're doing it elsewhere? There's where my concern.
That's a scandal. That is a tragedy, and that's an avoidable scandal in it, and that there is no way that something like this should stand. The sad thing is that unless it's publicized by people like your friend and yourself who are in the media, and you know when other people get aware of it, that people. It's amazing. Terry and I just had the dealings with the GSA and the U.S. Marshals Service on a national level down in Atlanta a couple weeks ago for the Unabomber auction, and the only reason that thing went forward is that we eventually, frankly, had to mobilize elements in both of those governmental agencies to do their own jobs.
Yeah,
or
no question.
Or it still wouldn't have happened, and that's 15 years in the making, Michael.
Yeah, no,
asked by the victims to come in and the victim families and say, please help us resolve this.
There's no question. But the problem, I think, that we're having, and I think, I don't know if I've said it when we've been talking, but I don't know if you heard it or not. I watched a congressman, and if I could have written his name down and would have remembered it. I watched him on one of the news channels say, the silly Constitution. You know, that we are and Nancy Pelosi who cares what it says, sign it, you'll find out later. The point of contention is this: we're supposed to be governed by a rule of law. I know how well aware you are of that.
That's our deal.
Yes, but we're not, and that's what the problem is. We're not, and this bureaucracy. No, the bureaucrat. To define a bureaucrat is not an elected official. It is somebody who's paid to do a job. What's going on instead of making sure the rules are met, they're starting to interpret the rules. You go to court to court to court. Time and place, geographical location, wherever the case may be, and you're going to find different things and different ways people are being treated. When we start to look at, in some of the countries, I think it was in Michigan, Sharia law within the court system, give me a break here. And these are not just things, that, you know, it's all over the news. Why are we tolerating and allowing this?
Why are we tolerating and allowing this? Why do we tolerate and allow politicians to do this all the time? Why is this tolerated? People lose attention. People's attention spans are short, and they have other things on their minds. Everybody right now is in this financial whirlwind that everybody's in, is just trying to hunker down and see what happens at the end.
Kathy, let me give you
position they're in.
Let me give you an answer to that question. I'm serious. Let me give you the why.
I'm not. I know.
I know. I've got this one down pat. It's called, what are you going to give me? And the reason that I'll do something that'll quote unquote bend the rules, do this, because somebody's going to give me something. We are in a rewards based culture. We always have been. Your mom says to you, clean up your room. We'll take you to the show. Do this. I'll give you that. What I give you that African-American woman, we've talked about it, that was standing, I think it was in New York, that was standing up on the fence naked, screaming and yelling that, you know, I was promised rent, I was promised food, I want those things, I'm not getting down until I get it. It's promise, and I'm not talking about the administration, anybody. It's promise, promise, promise. So if I know I'm going to get something from you, it's going to do me. I'm going to shut my mouth and get it. And that's what's gone on. And I think it's a shame.
I have this sense of entitlement.
There was a kid out of New York, I think, within the last month or so. He was a young African-American boy, 25 years old, was killed. He also had 6 daughters and 3 sons. Each one was getting $1,350 from the government, and they were getting welfare. You know, multiply it. Do the math. You know, something's wrong.
Yeah. Well, I have no rejoinder to that.
I'm gonna have a bunch of kids and quit. That's what I'm gonna do.
No. Oh God, are you gonna do it all over again?
Yeah, no. You know, on second thought, forget it. I don't want to.
Yeah.
All right, we're starting to run out of time, and I'm gonna sit here and wait till next week when you come back.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Oh, thank you. Website we can find you at.
HomelandInsecurityTheBlog.com, Michael.
Wonderful. And we will, Kathy Puckett, we will see you next week. And I think there's a cure to all of it. I really do.
I do, too. They just need to talk to us.
You don't take a knife to a gunfight. You fight fire with fire. And if money's causing the problem, you use money to fight it.
Okay. Good night, Michael.
Okay, good night.
Mountains and jungles and desert oasis, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Connie Huff up next with us.
When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Boston.
Former cardiac and emergency room nurse with 20 years experience, diet nurse Connie Huff, BSN-RN, is the ultimate champion for frustrated, depressed, overweight souls. Her Rejuvenate Your Body, Free Your Life program is the result of an in-depth study of the physiology of fat loss and the biology of fat storage and fat utilization. And let us say, Connie, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Michael. How are you? Glad to be here.
And thank you so much for being here. You know, thank goodness I've never had a weight problem, but for the most part, you know, we complain, we go to this diet, we go to that diet, we go to this program, and always end up coming back to quote unquote square one. There's usually something missing, because I've seen people lose, men and women, they lose weight and everything is fine. The next thing you know, you see them a month later, they've gained the weight and plus, and they're starting a new program. What's the missing link? What have you found that will cause that bridge to be able to accomplish someone's goals?
Well, first off, I have to say we hate people like you.
By the way,
no problem with their weight.
Wait, we have the I Hate Michael Ray fan club out there.
Yeah.
I can eat two meals and three desserts and lose a half a pound the next morning. So I'm well hated. You can join if you want to be one of the chairmen.
Oh, that's all right. Luckily, you know, the nice thing is that. You know, we live in an unprecedented glut of nutrient deficiency right now. I'm getting terrible feedback. I'm sorry if this is not sounding right.
Okay, well, they're listening there at the board, and guys, if you can fix that, that would be great. Let's continue on, and if it gets worse, I can always have you come back, but go ahead.
Okay, great. the problem is that our food has been manipulated to make it very malnutritious and malicious, and it's not delicious and nutritious anymore. We've become addicted to food, and really, when you think about it, where did you ever learn how to eat?
we're going to get her back on a different line because somehow it wasn't working. So while we're waiting for, there's a wonderful article written by an Australian dentist. It's called To Kill an American. Oh, wait, do we have her back? Okay, it's called To Kill an American. You probably missed this in the rush of all the news, but there was actually a report on someone in Pakistan had published in a newspaper an offer to reward anyone who killed an American, any American. So an Australian dentist wrote an editorial the following day to let everybody know what an American actually is, so they would know when they found one. And it's like this, and this is what he wrote. An American is English or French or Italian, Irish, German, Spanish, Polish, Russian, or Greek. An American may also be Canadian, Mexican, African, Indian, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Australian, Iranian, Asian, Arab, Pakistani, or Afghan. An American may also be a Comanche, a Cherokee, Osage, Blackfoot, Navajo, Apache, Seminole, or one of the many of the other tribes known as Americans. An American is Christian, or he could be Jewish, or Buddhist, or Muslim. In fact, there are more Muslims in America than Afghanistan. The only difference is that in America, they're free to worship as each one of them chooses to do so. An American is also free to believe in no religion, for that he will only answer to God, not to the government, or be armed thugs claiming to speak for the government or for God. An American lives in the most prosperous land in the history of the world. And the root of that prosperity can be found in the Declaration of Independence, which recognizes the God-given right of each person in the pursuit of happiness. An American is generous, and Americans have helped out just about every other nation in the world in their time of need, never asking a thing in return. When Afghanistan was overrun by the Soviet Army 20 years ago, Americans came with arms and supplies to enable the people to win back their country. And as of the morning of September 11th, Americans had given more than any other nation to the poor in Afghanistan. The national symbol of America, the Statue of Liberty, welcomes your tired, your poor, the wretched refuse of your teeming shores, the homeless, tempest-tossed. These, in fact, are the Americans who built America. And some of them were working in the Twin Towers the morning of September 11th, 2001. Earning a better life for their families. And it's been told that the World Trade Center, the victims, were from at least 30 different countries, cultures, and first languages, including those that aided and abetted the terrorists. So you can try to kill an American if you must. Hitler did. So did General Toho and Stalin and Mao Zedong and other bloodthirsty tyrants in the world. But in doing so, you would just be killing yourself. Because Americans are not a particular people from a particular place. They are the embodiment of the human spirit of freedom. Everyone who holds to that spirit everywhere in America. And if you want to kill an American, you're going to have a really tough time doing it. Guys, did we get her back yet?
I'm here.
Oh, you're there. Oh, I'm sorry they didn't tell me. I would have stopped.
That's okay. That's okay. I was enjoying your seat.
Thank you. So by the way, what we're dealing with is, and I understand, and stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, but I truly understand, Connie, when it comes down to it, our body is nothing more than an electrochemical factory. You know, it's made up of hormones, and there's neural pathways, and one neuron sends a message to another one that causes the body to react, and so on and so forth. And isn't it getting a handle on this that will allow you to be able to deal with how you eat, why you eat, and get down to where you want to be?
Absolutely right, because they've got those marketing schemes out there that say, you know, obey this one simple rule to lose belly fat or cut 100 calories a day to lose 100 pounds. And your body actually thinks that's absolutely bogus. You know, you have 100 trillion cells, over 600 muscles, 206 bones, 62,000 miles of blood vessels. And so do you really think it's going to obey just one simple rule? You know, that's part of the problem is that people will not take the time to be informed and equip themselves on actually how their bodies work. And it's not that difficult, especially if you get some help in the process about learning about your body. And that's what I do. I like to simplify something that's very complicated and help people to nourish their bodies and understand that that's where it starts. You have to understand how the body works and what it needs, and this is where people get into trouble with all of the other diet programs.
Okay, so in essence, the program itself, how did you establish the program? I know you went from 240 pounds to hot in a bikini contest, so how did you do it?
Well, you know, I had an aha moment. You know, I had just turned 40 and was having a tough time tying my shoelaces one day. And, you know, I can remember thinking, gosh, here I'm a nurse, and I had taken care of many cardiac patients before and had advised them on what to eat because of my training, but yet I myself didn't know what to eat. And, you know, that was a huge point for me because I thought, I'm not going to go on another diet. I've got to figure this thing out. So I used my knowledge of anatomy and physiology, and I started researching. And what I did is I started studying people that I thought really knew how to slash fat in their diet.
Let me hold you up for a minute. Can you hear me? Okay. What I'm going to do is the reception is terrible, and I really believe that what you have to say needs to be heard. So
I'm going to try one more time on the second line.
Go. Okay, we're going to try one more time.
If I'm getting the feedback,
okay.
I'm even getting the feedback myself. Okay.
Go ahead and talk about attitude for a minute. And Charles Swindell wrote this, and I thought it was wonderful. It was attitude. The longer I lived, the more I realized the impact of attitude on life. And attitude to me is more important than facts. It's more important than the past, than education, than money, than circumstances, than failures, and even successes, than what other people think they say they do. It's more important than appearance, gifted, or skill. That's attitude now. And it'll make or break a company, a church, a home. The remarkable thing is that we have a choice every day regarding the attitude that we'll embrace for that particular day. When you get up, you have a choice. You can't change your past. You can't change the fact that people are going to act in a certain way. You can't change the inevitable. The only thing that you can do is play in the role, play on that one string that you have, and that's your attitude. And I'm convinced that life's 10% what happens to me and 90% of how we react to it, and so it is with you. And you are in charge of your attitude, believe it or not. You can't stop somebody from walking up and smacking you in the nose, but you can control how you feel about it. Connie, did we get you back?
I'm back. Let's try one more time,
right? Okay. Now, by the way, I think what we'll do is, we got about 5 minutes, I think. So let's talk for the 5 minutes. I'm going to have Susie Greenman reschedule you so we can make sure that you get the full amount of time, because we do want to hear what you have to say. So let's go back now. When you decided, okay, you dropped the weight, and obviously you had to drop a lot of weight to be able to fit into a bikini. From 240 pounds, how much weight did you drop?
I dropped 80 pounds in a year.
Okay, now was that scary to you?
No, it was fantastic. You know, it was a complete and total change. The changes that took place were beyond anything that I'd ever imagined. I never thought I could, you know, I was the type of person who never walked in public in shorts, much less get up on a stage in a bikini. So the changes were very profound. And, you know, it was a lot of work. And that's another thing that people just don't realize. They want everything quick and easy. And just like you were talking on your show earlier, this isn't quick and easy. This is learning how to feed your body so that it works for you. So then it's not such a big deal every couple of months that you got to go on another diet.
Let me hold you up, because I think I want to make sure that this point was made and not just, you know, glossed over, because you said make sure your body works for you. If you begin to understand the mechanisms, the mechanics of your body, you can make it work for you, and you can be in charge of it, and you can be in charge of the end result, can't you?
100%. 100%. You couldn't have said it better myself.
And I think really what we're dealing with is the difference between accidental and intentional results. If you know what you're doing, you know, knowing that a smile, you know, with that old adage that smiling's our best medicine, what actually happens when you smile, your brain actually releases endorphins, makes you feel good. And that in and of itself has an effect on the body. The food that you eat turns into certain kinds of chemistry. That has an effect on your body. By the time it comes from wherever it's manufactured, to the time it's processed, to the time it gets to your plate, and if you have the digestion to deal with it, maybe you're getting 10-15% of the nutrients that were originally there.
100%. And that is the problem today with our food sources, is they become so contaminated that we're not even able to absorb it. It's causing a lot of inflammation in the gut. It's causing a lot of other problems. And what people don't realize is your whole intestinal tract is your immune system. So if you're not digesting food and you're not getting enough of the right foods, you're going to end up sick and diseased much sooner than you ever need to be.
And the one thing that I've learned, you said the word immune system. The one thing I've learned, there's nothing you can take to cure yourself. I don't care if it's chemotherapy, radiation, nothing's going to cure you. But what it will do is it'll boost that immune system. It's the immune system's job to do the cure. And everything is ancillary out there.
Amen. You know, this is kind of my soapbox because you know, I used to be a cardiac and an emergency room nurse. And cardiac, you know, I'm a big drug pusher when I'm on that floor. And what people don't understand is that drugs by law, the proof of the medicine being, you know, they don't have to be safe. They only have to have benefits that outweigh the side effects. That's it. They do not have to be proven to be safe. So that's something that most people do not realize when they're watching an ad for a particular pill or a new drug that's coming out. That's why there's so many.
I think that the reception is getting worse. I'll tell you what. Give us your website, and then we're going to have you back on the show real quick, and we'll make sure everybody gets the information. And if anybody misses it, it'll be up on our website to contact you. So your website is?
It's eliminatefatnow.com, where you can find the blog, and myhelpmelosewaight.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Connie, thank you so much for joining us. And next time, it'll be much clearer, okay?
All righty, great. Hey,
good night.
Good night. Hey.
Comes the makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's falling. The music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this bit. That's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.